Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Word down your way. Testing 2-2.
Welcome to another edition of Word Down Your Way. I can still remember the excitement of these early Buzzcocks singles arriving in the NME offices where I was working at the time. And I've just had a rootle round in the attic and found my clear vinyl Razor Cuts bootleg from 1979. And you feel that all is well when you know that the group are still touring. They're currently in the middle of a world tour almost 50 years later and now led by Steve Diggle. Steve, it's lovely to see you. How are you doing?
Lovely to be here, yes.
And you're back home, aren't you, I think?
Yes, but we're on this never-ending tour, really. So I'm back home now, but at the end of the week, we're playing press, and then we go back to America and all this sort of thing, and Australia.
In Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I think that's the schedule. The 100 Club, yeah.
And the 100 Club, yeah.
And how's it going? Are there places where you get a particularly warm reception?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's a testament to the songs that we wrote years ago. You know, they still sort of test of time, and also I did a new album last year, and people loved that as well. You know, the key words to keep it relevant, and they love the new album when that fits in with the old stuff. And so, you know, it's still very much alive. You know, and at the shows, there's a lot of younger people coming, as well as people our age in the 50s and 60s, you know, spanning about three generations now. And it's amazing to see young kids. I used to be the same age as those in the audience at the front. Then I was old enough to be their fathers, and I'm sure I'm old enough to be some of their grandfathers. But, you know, they still keep coming and they love it, you know.
That must be so satisfying. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, look, we were going to just ask you about kind of early memories, really, of the whole idea of live performance. Can you remember the first groups you ever saw?
Yeah. Actually, one of them, I saw a group called Silverhead.
Oh, right. Silverhead. Michael Desbarres.
Michael Desbarres.
Nigel Harrison of Blondie on bass.
That's right. Yes. I saw them at a place called the Stone Ground in Manchester, which was...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It was sort of around the Gorton area.
Oh, yeah.
It was a little run-down place. And I think the week after they had Leo Sarum when he was dressed as a clown, you know.
Did you see him?
Yeah, because I think that was booked before he had got a bit of fame on Top of the Pops.
That's so right. That was his act, wasn't it?
Yes, he probably had to fill the contracts, and even though he'd been on Top of the Pops, he had to turn up at this really run-down nightclub with the sticky carpets and all that, you know.
But years ago, so was Michael Desbarres there in all his glam rock finery?
Yes, it was like there was like a cross between the Stones and the New York Dolls, in a sense, wasn't it? You know,
but and, it was 1972, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, the album 16 and Savage.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I liked. And he had songs like More Than Your Mouth Can Hold, though, and said odd titles.
Yes, Christ.
Hello, New York is another one. But they seemed quite good, that, you know, they had Robbie, somebody on guitar, slide guitar, and Michael Desbar's out across between Mick Jagger and, you know, that kind of thing. It was just exciting seeing that live, you know. Another group I saw live early on was Status Quo.
Oh, brilliant. Everybody.
Yeah.
Do you like Status Quo?
Yeah, yeah. My brother had a tape from college years ago, and it had all the early stuff on, you know, Mark Kelly's Greasy Spoon and Pizza and Maxic Men. And I think they just brought Paper Plane out, and that's somehow I got a ticket, you know.
Right.
And because I didn't know officially how to buy tickets, really. You know, we used to just kind of turn up.
Yeah.
The doorman used to be like Potter, you know. So somebody would go in, bring six tickets out, and then you'd go in and then hand them to somebody else, you know. And the doorman in those days was kind of like, you know, with the peak cap, where are you going? You know, and we'd get and see many things like that for free, you know. But I saw Bowie as well on the Ziggy Stardust tour as well.
Right. What did you look like at the time? Did you have long hair or what?
I had long hair, yeah. Because, I mean, I was a child of the 60s, you know. I think when my cousin had Little Richard and Chuck Berry and stuff, which I loved. But then the Beatles came along in 62. And so I'd be 7 years old then. I was primed to be. So the Beatles came out. I remember hearing Jimmy Hanley's radio show, and he used to play children's favourites. You know,
right.
you can't say Charlie Drake and Rolf Harris and people like that, Bernard Cribbins. And then one day this song Love Me Do came on, and it really stuck out, you know. And so I got into that. And also George Best in 1963, I think when the first Beatles album came out, he just joined Manchester United as a 17-year-old. So that crystallised my youth, really. It was like then, you know, it was the Kinks and the Stones and all those 60s group and Manchester United at the same time, you know. So
George Best felt like a pop star, didn't he? Don't you think?
He was. He was always the fifth Beatle. There's been many claiming that one, but he kind of was, you know.
He was.
And it was glamorous because when he didn't turn up for training, you know, that seemed really exciting, you know. Busby on the television going, I don't know where the lad is. And then he'd probably turn up after a three-day binge somewhere. He'd get on the pitch and score, you know. So he seemed very glamorous and he's very stylish and exciting because all the other footballers at the time seemed really old, you know. Even when they were 20, they looked about 35 with short back and sides.
They looked 30 years older than they actually were.
Yeah, and they had broken hair and short back and sides. Like you know,
it looked as if they'd gone through national service.
That's right.
Whereas George Best, like the Beatles, the same thing with the Beatles. They hadn't gone national service. Consequently, they'd grown their hair a bit.
Yes, maybe it was the National Service kind of mentality that they escaped from.
They were the first generation not to have to do it.
That's right, so
They were different, you know, yeah. So what about the level of punk in your life?
So then you sort of grew up, you know, it was the hippie days, the heavy metal days, you know, the Beatles split up, suddenly you had to get this high Janis Joplin voice called Robert Plant, you know. So I got into that and the Groundhogs and people like that. A guy used to say at school, the comprehensive school boys had the Led Zeppelin albums and the grammar school boys had the Deep Purple ones.
That's good.
And maybe that was true, you know. But
Deep Purple?
Yeah. You know, I like Led Zeppelin more because it's come from the blues, but I did like it. You know, Highway Star and all that's great. It was all good stuff, you know. And it was sort of relatively new then before it got a bit heavy metal started to get a bit weird in the 80s, you know.
As
Robert Plant said, we might be responsible for starting heavy metal, but we're not responsible for what it became, you know. So there was all that.
There was a time when every guitarist either wanted to be Ritchie Blackmore or Jimmy Page.
That's right. You looked at the ads. It was all looking for bass players and drummers and, Richard Blackmore, Jimmy Page. But then, along came Yes and people like that. And that was all right for a moment, you know, taking a mushroom and listening to Half Hour about them singing Mushrooms in the Sky. But suddenly, But when you're coming up, you know, to a million on the dole in the early 70s and things like that, and, you know, the songs are all getting too long at that time, you know, and all this concept things on ice, and it's hold on, we need something live and exciting. Now I'm coming up to 20 years old, you know. I did get a free ticket to see Patrick Mouratt. You know, we used to turn up with a free trade on, just blag our way in. And one time, Patrick Mouratt had replaced Rick Wakeman on the keyboards in Yes. And he was doing a solo thing. Well, he had a telephone exchange of ARP Odyssey things on the wall. Millions of them making blips and bleeps. Meaningless stuff, really, you know. I couldn't afford a guitar, so it was very difficult to relate to all that. And at the end of the show, he brought an Alpine horn out the size of the stage. I thought, he's got all that electronic gear and he still has to bring an Alpine on. And that's when I thought, something's got to change, you know.
That's brilliant. That's the very moment, isn't it?
That was the moment I thought.
The Alpine horn is the final nail in the coffin.
Oh, that was
final straw.
That was the final straw. It was like, he's got all that stuff, you know, all the electronics, and now he brings that out, and he's like, that's the final straw. And in my mind, I thought, something's got to change for me. And my brief was, let's do 3-minute songs, smash the gear up like the Who, and tell the audience to fuck off. So that was my working thing after
and
seeing
you saw
that.
You saw the Pistols at the Free Trade Hall, didn't you? The Trade Hall, Leicester Trade Hall, sorry. Whatever it was, so, June the 4th, I think? Yeah, 76.
Yes. So what happened was I'd kind of formed a band with a couple of kids around the corner from me, but they had jobs and they didn't seem to mean, you know. So in the local paper, I just answered an ad and I said, I'll meet you outside the Free Trade Hall and we'll write our own song, smash the equipment and all this kind of stuff. So I went down, because I was going to this bar, Cox's Bar, around the corner from me. Free Trade Hall, which was a great Boddington's pub at the time. So I'm stood outside the Free Trade Hall, and there's a bloke like dressed in all leather, like the Elvis Comeback Tour, you know. And it was Malcolm McLaren. And he said, they're in here, the Sex Pistols. I said, I know, but I'm waiting for somebody. I'm going to form a group myself. He said, oh, no, they're inside. And I thought, I don't remember anything about this. So I wandered in and there was Pete Shelley collecting tickets on the door. So I said,
that's
okay.
Where you met him?
That's where I met him, yeah.
Amazing.
And then, so I said, I'll see you in the bar. He came up to the bar after. And I realised it was a bit like a Brian Rix farce. We were talking at cross purposes. They were supposed to meet somebody else. And I was supposed to meet this other guy. I think they're still outside waiting now for this day. Somebody should tell them it's not going to happen.
Probably fought crisis many years later.
Yeah, probably did. So we're talking now, and I thought, I don't remember saying that on the phone, but I do remember this. And so anyway, we went down the stairs and watched the Sex Pistols come on. And there was hardly anybody there that first one, you know, the first few rows. But we sat at the back, there was rows and rows of empty seats, talking about this thing called the Buzzcocks, you know. The Sex Pistols came on, you know, had no regard for the audience, looked like a glamorous New York Dolls and other things. And it was the excitement, really, you know, the fast sort of 3-minute songs and all that. It was just like, well, to quote Yeats, a terrible beauty was born, you know. And that's what it was, really. So the next day, me, Howard and Pete all plugged into this tiny amplifier, singing songs like Orgasm Addicts and Boredoms. It sounded terrible, you know. It sounded awful, but it was exciting. All three of us were this tiny amp. And that was the birth of the Buzzcocks, really, you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So you grew directly after seeing the Pistols. And then I think supported the Pistols a few weeks later.
A few weeks later, they came back. Because Howard or Pete was on a college trip to London, and the Pistols, I think they played in some nightclub somewhere or Chelsea Art College. They hadn't even had any press at this time, really. Probably like a one column inch or something. So Howard, I think, had said, like, if you want to come to Manchester, we'll put a show on, which he did, and that's where I met them. And a few weeks later, we had about, it seemed, 3 weeks to get our thing together to open up for them, you know. Then all the press came down for the free drinks, the free hotel, to review the Sex Pistols, and lo and behold, there's a band called the Buzzcocks, a local band, which I think we was responsible for putting the provinces on the map.
Putting Manchester on the map. That's true, because it'd been all about London, hadn't it?
That's right. And then suddenly from there, you had a Liverpool scene and a Scottish scene and Sheffield scene. It was like, well, if they can do it in Manchester, you know, and all that. So I always say, if Jesus was born in Bethlehem, I think punk really started that day in Manchester, you know.
You're right.
Because the Pistols got a lot of coverage, and we did, from that gig, you know. That was the first time the press had gone like, we're going to go to that gig and review it, you know. And it was in the Sounds, NME, and all that stuff, you know.
You never thought at that time, I'm going to be still singing these songs in what, 50 years' time or whatever it is?
No.
Never. But
They still do Shakespeare, and he's older than me.
No, absolutely.
So I've still got a bit of time.
But he would be just surprised, wouldn't he?
He would. No, I mean, it was all about the moment, really. It was just the excitement of the moment, you know. And but the other thing, we thought, the other idea was, we'll make the most uncommercial music possible. So if you listen to Boredom, the Spiral Scratch EP, it sounds really rough and horrible, but beautiful at the same time. Because we had Martin Hanna, who I don't really think had been in a studio, but he said he knows something about production. When the engineer at the studio was putting it right, he'd pull all the knobs and twist things away, and it all sounded weird, and this terrible sound we had on Spiral Scratch, but very unique and brilliant. So, because we did that because we thought, if we take the demo tape to London, they'll laugh us out of the building, it's, you know. So we had to make our first independent single, which I think was up there with, probably Stiff may have been doing something at the same time, but the Spiral Scratch, it's seen as a stroke of genius, but it was a stroke of necessity as well, you know. We borrowed £500 of, took some girl's student money, and I think some of Pete Shelley done, and made this record, which inspired a lot of people to do that, you know.
£500 quid, a lot of money, wasn't it, at the time?
Yeah.
Well, huge amount.
Yeah, well, this posh student had about a couple of, you know, I don't know how much she had for a grant, but we took half of it and borrowed it. I think a bit off Pete Shelley's dad and a bit here and there. £500 was a lot, but we made 1,000 records. And that inspired a lot of groups to do that, you know. I think it was almost one of the first to do that in that era, you know, because we just thought we wouldn't get a record in.
Who were the other groups that you were looking at, the other punk groups you were looking at in terms of stagecraft, as it were, that you were nicking ideas from about the way you performed?
Well, it all I started to really, you know, I loved the class, you know, all our stable mates were good. I mean, we knew the Pistols from, you know, the first gig of opening up for them. Then we went on the White Riot tour with the Clash, so I loved all that as well. But also, what I realised, when Pete was doing a lot of the singing, and I'd sing about a third of the songs, if that live, I thought, I'm bored, I've got nothing to do. So you can see why Pete Townsend starts running about, you know. And there was that sense of energy and urgency within the songs. And so I reacted to that. And some people thought I was doing bits of Pete Townsend, but really, I was starting to think, I see where he gets it from, you know what I mean? But also seeing Chuck Berry run up and down, you know, in the early days, and Little Richard jumping on the piano. So all that was inherent in me, because when I first got on the stage, I thought, if you read that book, The History of Mr. Polly, at the end it says everybody finds their place in life. In The History of Mr. Polly, he gets married, settles down, really doesn't like it. Sex fires at a bookshop he's working in, creates his own death, you know. They think he's died. And then he ends up running a pub and fishing. And I think I found my place on the stage.
There's so when a parallel.
I found my place there. But also, it's like the whole of my life came out in there. So that's the movement to me, you know. All the angst, all the experience. You know, I kind of feel like I'm channeling that when I'm on the stage, you know. It's not some act I've adopted. It's like, you know, open the tap of living an experience for me. So it comes out quite explosive and controlled in some ways, you know. It's just that fire and love and energy in your belly of what art does, really, you know. So,
well, Pete, I did move around, but Pete very sadly died in 2018. Yes. And so how was it for you adjusting to becoming the lead singer of the group?
Well, there was really live. There was kind of two of us. It was like a two-way pull. Like in America, they used to call us Lennon and McCartney in a blender. But, you know, I was doing a lot on the live front, you know, waving the guitar around and inspiring the audience a lot. You know, doing a lot of the frontman job, getting them all excited while he was changing the microphone sometimes, you know. So there was always that there. So it was just a matter of moving from stage right to the middle, really. But I do miss him as a brother and, you know, all the experiences of those early days of the idea of creating the group and, you know, all the aesthetics behind it and stuff. Incidentally, when we did sign a deal, Scratch was put back 3 weeks, the release date, because the pressing plant said, we're not printing this filth, you know. It took us 3 weeks to explain its art, you know. And that title...
It's art. It's all right. It's art.
Yeah. So it was delayed for 3 weeks because they said, we're infusive. You knew when they said that you was onto something good, you know. It's absolutely filth. We're not printing it. Well, we're going... He's probably come from William Burroughs or something, you know. It's William Burroughs, don't care, you know what? And what was good about that record, many years later, people would say, I bought that when I was 16, and my parents would come running up the stairs going, what's he saying? Oh, Gasomatic, what are you listening to? You know. So a lot of kids, it was a delight to annoy the parents with that one. What that filth, you know, for all that. But we can understand it because everybody, we thought, we knew what an orgasm was, you know.
Yeah. So,
except the record company or the pressing plant.
So you're currently a three-piece, is that right?
No, we've got an extra, another guitarist in.
Oh, right, okay.
So he's been with us, yeah. Was a kind of a three-piece. So I thought, after Pete died, we were due to play the Albert Hall with Pete as the Buzzcocks as a gig. And sadly, he died before that. So we made it a memorial gig, invited a few guests and did it like that. But then we still had a few shows. So the manager said to me, because I'd done these Steve Diggle solo albums, I've got this box set, do you want to carry on a Steve Diggle or Buzzcocks? And really, I wish I'd done the two because I like my solo stuff and I like the Buzzcocks. But then we had some other gigs booked, so carried on as a Buzzcocks. But I said, if we do a tour, which we did just before COVID, I need to put a single out to make it relevant, you know. I'm not just doing, like, the greatest hits tour. I don't want to get caught up in that, you know. Because growing up with Dylan and Bowie and the Beatles, they always had a different album, you know. It was about that to me as much as just, you know, not playing the greatest hits, you know. And so we had a single out, and then it was COVID. So I wrote this album, Sonics in the Soul. And it's the first, normally you get a bunch of songs and put them together in the studio, sequence them. But with this one, I wrote them to sequence, so it was like a whole journey, you know. So, like, when you read a book, you have to start at the beginning and get to the end to know what it's about, you know, rather than this cherry-picking idea people have now. Oh, I'll just, you know, download the single and all that stuff off Spotify. So I tried to make Sonics in the Soul as a journey. I thought, well, you've got three openers there as part of the roller coaster, right? Now here's the bad news. We're going down, you know. But I wrote it like that. I said, now we need another one like this, and now I need one like that. And that's the first time I've done that. And it does seem a complete thing for the album, you know what I mean? It does make sense of the full journey. And that kind of wonderful thing we used to get in the early 70s, when you listen to an album as a whole meal, your life would change, you know? It was like the whole album meant something, you know? Which seems to have started getting lost, you know? You know, because people just make albums with a lot of singles on. You know?
When you go out now, you play the new stuff and the old stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
In fact, to prove my point, because there was a few doubters, how can he carry on without Pete Shelley? 3/4 of the set was the songs I wrote, you know? And I found myself doing less of his. Only to prove a point, like, look, I'm out here doing my own material, the songs I wrote, all the songs we wrote together, you know. Like Fast Cars, Promises, Why Can't I Touch It, they're all songs that originally came from me, you know. And he might wrote a verse, but I wrote the music in the chorus. So there was all that. And also there's some pertaining to Pete that are kind of personal and his look on life, which I have sang them and I've done so many reels, and I thought, it's not for me, this, you know. I don't want to be getting into those kind of roles. But nobody has ever bothered, you know, what we deliver is good, you know. And also, you know, I've been pulling out some obscure album tracks in the middle. It's been interesting to, it's like at least a 3-tier set, at least, because you've got the kind of classic singles that you've kind of got to do. The solid fans want to hear the odd album tracks. And also, you've got new songs off a new album. So it's a lot to put in within an hour and a half, you know.
And you're finishing at the 100 Club, which must have a few memories, because that's where you played, didn't you, in the punk rock festival in 76?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of come full circle with that.
Yeah.
We did that punk festival back in the day, and I think we're doing about 2 or 3 nights at the 100 Club at the end of the year, yeah. So that'll be nostalgic to go there. And it's a great honour to touch base with them, because we've just been out in America playing massive shows, and the same in Germany, huge shows, you know. It's been phenomenal response out in Germany recently.
What size venues do you play there in Germany?
Well, massive places. I don't know how to call, but huge.
Yeah.
I mean, there was thousands there in Berlin. I can't believe it. It's all of, so you've got those kind of ones. And so it'd be nice to do the 100 Club, you know.
Yeah.
And in America, we've been doing these big festivals and stuff, you know. But now, on the big shows, when we got more time, I can bring the acoustic guitar out now.
Oh, and really?
Because we had that song, Love Is Lies. But so I kind of calmly, you know, we wind the audience up into a frenzy, go off and then come on, but got to bring you right down with this.
Right.
Take them back up. But what I found myself doing is now I'm sort of probably going back to the prog rock days or something. I'm starting to play a lot of acoustic before I get to the, like, as if I'm playing some reprise off Tommy or something.
Yeah.
I'm like doing all this, busking all this acoustic work, like, did, but it's not exactly that, but And then I stroke it down into Lovey Sykes. So.
Again, something else you could never have imagined, surely, in 1976.
No, it wasn't.
You play acoustic versions. It's amazing. No,
it wasn't allowed then. But I've kind of broadened out the set a bit and our approach to it now. So it's a little bit more majestic because you kind of, you know, even singing some of them songs like Orgasmatics, I've got to sing them as an older kind of bloke now, not as like a naughty teenager or something, you know. But everything you sing and the persona and the phrasing, which is the kind of thing you learn off Dylan, really, isn't it? You know, he phrases things different all his life, you know, and that's an interesting point. And also the way the songs are delivered and all that, the way we do it now is makes the band very now, if you see what I mean. Rather than trying to recreate the moment of 76, because you can only do things in certain times, I think, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it feels a great place right now at the moment. But I did laugh to myself about this acoustic thing, you know.
It's amazing.
Yeah, you know.
Well, it's fantastic to talk to you, Steve. Brilliant. Yeah. And you're back, when's the next date?
We're in Preston, then we go to Greece, we do all this, and I think by September we do a massive East Coast story in the States. We come back and then we go to Australia.
Australia, New Zealand.
Yeah. All that stuff.
That's so fantastic. It's, all you've got a world following. Brilliant.
It is. People forget that. We're going to South America as well. The new manager, because sadly the manager died sort of a year ago as well. After Pete died, I had to get rid of the manager died as well. And but he's kind of said, like, people don't realise how well known in the world the Buzzcocks are, you know, and it's kind of true. We used to, you know, go around the world, but some other groups are known for it, but it's gone. I didn't imagine how many the Buzzcocks are. So South America, Chile, we all that. But in the meantime, now in this gap, I'm writing the new album.
Right.
I think it's going to be called Attitude Adjustment. That gives me leeway to do something different with the Buzzcocks, if you see what I mean. Yeah. This time, I've got some that the flavour of Buzzcocks, but I've got to take it somewhere else as well. You know, you don't want to rely on the same path all the time. You know? Yeah.
So well, that's fantastic.
I've got a song called Queen of the Scene, which is about all these celebrity people that don't know whether they're boys, girls, transfusion. Oh, you know, they get the fame and they're very confused and, you know, traumatised. So I thought that's pretty relevant. Another one called Heavy Streets, which is about getting your phone nicked in the street or getting stabbed and falling to the floor. So they're all relevant subjects. Oh,
very contemporary.
Exactly, that's what I mean.
And meanwhile, those two blokes are still waiting outside the Free Trade Hall to meet him.
Yes. Yes, that's right, David. If anybody sees them, can they
if
say...
If anybody you know, sees them, tell them they can go home.
Go home, yes.
It's all over.
It's all over, yeah.
Brilliant to talk to you, Steve.
Nice to talk.
Thanks very much.
Word down your way. Testing 2-2.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.